Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Hospice News Elevate podcast. I'm Holly Vossel, senior reporter for Hospice News and Palliative Care News. In this episode, we'll explore the diverse challenges of establishing a strong foundation of hospice volunteer-based services. We'll discuss how hospices can go beyond the minimum volunteer requirements to provide a wider bandwidth of support. A quick note before we begin. Our Hospice News podcasts are possible thanks to those in the field willing to share their insights. Let us know if you're interested in participating or sponsoring an upcoming podcast episode by reaching out to us at editor@hospicenews.com. And with that, we'll begin our journey into today's topic. Hello, Greg. Thanks so much for joining our podcast talk today.
Hi, Holly. Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here and talk about this, my favorite topic.
Yeah, I think a good place to start is really examining what's important to understand about what this volunteer requirement is in the Medicare hospice benefit and how it relates to that care delivery at the end of life.
Right. So, you know, in 1974, the Health, Education, and Welfare Department recognized hospice as a concept of care. And for about 10 or 15 years before that, you know, the UK and Elizabeth Kubler-Ross in the US started paying attention to people who are dying and not, and ways to support them. So, in 1982, the Congress created the Medicare hospice benefit, whose primary purpose of that was just to make hospice care part of Medicare. Mm-hmm. And relating to that, since volunteers were such an instrumental part of getting hospice going, everyone was a volunteer at the beginning, and all the disciplines were. And obviously, as it moved further into the mainstream of healthcare, the professionals were acting as professionals, and volunteers continued to do their role as volunteers. And Congress wanted to maintain that perspective because volunteerism was so important to getting the program started. So they made part of the law was that 5% of all hours, of all clinical hours, for example, in a month, if there were 100 clinical hours, 5% of those hours had to be expended. An equivalent of that had to be expended by volunteers. So 5 hours out of the 100 would require an equivalent of volunteer participation in direct support of patient care. And there's the roles of volunteers, which we might just talk about briefly later. But the 5% only applies to directly to activities that are in direct support of the patient or the family, and also bereavement care when the patient dies. Right. So anyway, it's really important, and it's something that any volunteer, any hospice program has to create, be supported by volunteers and meet this requirement if you want to get reimbursed by HHS for the services you provide, which is, I don't know what the percentage is, but it's pretty high. 80 or 90% of hospices are reimbursed by the government. So,
right. And I think I appreciate that history too, because a lot of hospices know this as a regulation and a compliance factor, but understanding like where it came from, why it's important in their payment system. I appreciate that you walking us through that. So on that note of compliance, I think a good question was really, what are the resources that hospices have that can help them make sure they're kind of that compliance tractor, you know, the tracker when it comes to the volunteer-based services?
Yeah, so, we do provide services to hospices and where they can monitor and manage their program and monitor. This 5% is a real critical item. It's probably the essence of obviously volunteers play an important role, but as far as the compliance part of it goes, you know, they have to have this program. So, there are tools where the hospices, we create, for example, a library of forms that volunteers can use for the various kinds of roles that they play. And then the program keeps track of the volunteers' activities and also does the decision making about, you know, what falls into the 5% category and what does not. And so we keep a tabulation of that, and it's useful to the it's useful both to the volunteers, and sometimes there are people who are getting psychology degrees and sometimes do come in as a volunteer and they want to know how much time they spent, how many, what their mileage was, and all those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. So those kinds of resources are pretty important for and hospices do these in different ways. There are resources outside the hospice, and sometimes hospices create their own mechanisms for monitoring all these. And typically, since the beginning, when technology started coming into play around 2008, 2009, when Obama initiated the High Tech Act, and High Tech is an acronym. I don't remember what it all stands for. It basically was encouraging technology use in the healthcare programs. So so electronic health records or electronic medical records, however we refer to it, EHR or EMRs, typically do not include the resources that the volunteer program. So typically they use tools that are separate from the EHR, and then they'll use those tools to provide data that gets sent to the EHR to monitor this, primarily to monitor this, the activities that were done and a report by each volunteer. And so all that data gets stored on the EHR. And like I said, there's different tools that are available to do that.
But I think tracking all that data is really important, not just to make sure they're compliant, but to make sure, even like you mentioned, that for the volunteers to understand their impact, and that could lead into, you know, the retention and a strong, you know, desire to make that impact. Okay.
Well, yeah, there's an interesting aspect of that. Let me just add one more point. Sure. Here is that one of the things that we encourage is journaling. You know, in my experience as a volunteer, initially, you know, I did a lot of journaling and actually I worked, I did it in a residential facility, and also the volunteers were all working together. And so journaling is a really effective way to allow volunteers to keep, you know, to look back 20 years and say, oh my gosh, I did all these great things, and, you know, and feel proud about what they did, but also to learn from. And so anyway, those journaling is another piece of this, although it's not a formal way to do it, but it is a way that actually volunteers can actually communicate with staff, mm-hmm. and the volunteer coordinators and so on, plus maybe write a book or something about their experience.
You never know. So how have you really seen this hospice volunteer landscape evolve over time? You have such a, you know, a rich history since, you know, 1996 in this space. I would love to hear your thoughts on this.
Yeah, the main driver to the changes that I've seen are related to hospice moving deeper and deeper into the mainstream, in mainstream medicine, and the requirements get tighter. And the other major shift has been the ratio of nonprofit hospices versus the for-profits. And there's a different business model there. And the impact of those different models affect that the way that resources are allocated and what their requirements are. So that's probably the biggest change. And what's happened over time is The things that, so when the hospice benefit was first created, and the law was written, and every once in a while, you know, HHS comes out with some modifications to what the requirements are, but it's pretty stable in terms of the volunteers. But they explicitly did not, or intentionally did not, when they were describing what the volunteer roles would be, they didn't state that very in very much detail, because they didn't want to limit what volunteers could do. If you wrote down, then the whatever they wrote down would be viewed as the law, and anything outside of that, you know, wouldn't be useful. And so that was the intention of not being explicit. And so the way it was before, early on, was that volunteers who could be any kind of a discipline were doing all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And then as the professionals moved away and the volunteers kept doing things, they were doing a lot of things that you just can't do anymore. Mm-hmm. And so what that does is it complicates, you know, you're narrowing down what the volunteer can do, and maybe making the experience of being a volunteer and helping people in whatever way you can. When you start limiting that, a volunteer's interest may not be as great because of what they're being limited in what they do. Mm-hmm. So you're wanting to, you know, satisfy that 5% requirement, which is really difficult. It is a challenge for hospices to do. And so by the trend of limiting what they can do is making it more difficult to meet that 5% requirement.
Yeah. No, that does make sense when you kind of unpack it like that. And as far as some of the picking apart some of those challenges a bit more right now and what's going on for hospices now, what do you think would you name as far as the biggest headwinds that are impacting, you know, greater hospice volunteerism involvement? You know, I've heard anecdotally just from providers over the years, you know, say that there's a lot of lasting impacts from that pandemic when they weren't as able to do as many in-person activities, but they got creative. But so that's one I can think of so far. What have you seen, and what do you think are some of the trends that are challenging as far as growing their volunteer base?
Yeah, the pandemic destroyed a lot of hospice volunteer programs, and even just the hospices, the number of subscribers that subscribe to our service, we probably lost about 90% of those customers, or, you know, subscribers that are Hospice Volunteer Association members. So that has been a major impact that really, really hurt the hospice industry in terms of the volunteer programs. So they lost their volunteer management. They lost the majority of their volunteers, and so that would be the biggest impact. The other thing that's going on is the involvement of the volunteers and the tools that the volunteers have to do their work. You know, hospices always want to respect the time that volunteers are giving. And so if you have the right support tools, you can minimize the amount of administrative time that volunteers are doing and have them be able to focus on just going and seeing that patient or that family. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned that the changes in the business model. And another thing that I've noticed is that the HIPAA laws, you know, the protection of protected health information, all clinicians, anyone that's working in the healthcare industry is under the, you know, restriction to protect privacy. And what I've seen over the years is that honestly, there's really a lack of knowledge of what the intention was and its application of HIPAA. And so what happens is you get quality assurance managers and things like that that are looking at HIPAA from the organization view. And when it comes to volunteers, it tends to get very narrow. I think that goes against what the intent of the law was, if you read it and specifically what it was doing. So that's another headwind in the sense that volunteers are being restricted about what they can learn about serving the patient and what they know about the family and everything. And it's as a volunteer, it's really interesting about, you know, the volunteer compared to clinicians. Clinicians are interacting with the families and the patients from a perspective of their discipline. And they go in and they're serving the patient from their perspective. The interesting thing about the volunteer is the volunteer is going in with a very, very broad perspective. And they don't, in the situation that they're being put into, they're not trained to. They actually have to learn from experience about getting involved with the family and it just takes time to get used to doing that and not being having any expectation about what you're going to do because it's so different from time to time. So by having this HIPAA restriction being very narrow goes against HIPAA. The volunteers are part of the team, and I just found that I can do a lot better the more I know about the families and the patient. I can serve them better and serve the team better. There are just so many situations where I was getting information from the family that the clinical team wasn't. And it was very useful information in helping serve the family and meet their needs.
Mm-hmm. It's a whole different perspective sometimes for volunteers at the bedside than, you know, what they're getting from that social worker, nurse, or chaplain that's coming as well. So, that's a good point to highlight. As far as kind of some of the strategic sort of building blocks to growing a strong, sustainable base of hospice volunteers, what would you say is really important to help these volunteers feel best supported in their roles? I think as we were talking about this before the podcast and preparing, kind of mentioned things as far as navigating that burnout, the continuous education, the need for that, and having, you know, peer-based support and training. Can you unpack that a little bit deeper for our listeners?
Sure. Training is very important, but I would say the first thing to start with is creating a sense of community and between the volunteers, because volunteers are working sort of in isolation. This is one of the challenges that I didn't mention earlier when we were talking about what are some of the challenges that volunteers have. For the most part, most of the care is done in homes or in facilities, and they're doing it on their own, and the amount of interaction with the staff and compared to other clinicians, they may go to an office and there's more interaction than they have weekly team meetings and so on. Where the volunteer doesn't have that exposure and they're pretty much on their own. So I think that that creating a sense of community and giving volunteers a chance to come together and share their stories and to maybe have a meal together, potluck or something, that's really one of the things I found the most impactful for me especially when I was getting started. The other things that are important are, I sense that the different departments within the hospice, rely on the chaplains work together and the social workers kind of know what they're doing. And then they come together, for the team meetings and so on. But when it comes to the rest of the organizations, understanding that I think they, you know, they rely on the volunteer program managers and the volunteer coordinators that, you know, they're managing the program. And then that's their interface to knowing what's going on and what volunteers are doing and how they support each other as a company. And what I found is, especially when we mentioned the impact of the pandemic, I see that more and more a volunteer coordinator may last a year or two and then leaves. And then the volunteers may have been there, maybe new, or they may have been there for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And, but the program is sort of, in a challenging place, when a volunteer coordinator leaves and they have to hire a new one. And then some of the responsibilities, if it's a multi-office hospice, another volunteer coordinator from another office will end up, you know, being the volunteer coordinator for both to support another office until they get the volunteer coordinator. And sometimes it can take 6 months. So I think that you know, one thing I would say that maybe organizations should think about is more interaction and better understanding what the volunteer program does. Because it's the volunteer coordinator's background, you know, when you're in a nursing group or a social work, those people all know what their role is and what's important, what's not important. And then when you get into the volunteer coordinators, typically, you know, for small hospitals, this is the only volunteer coordinator. So there's sort of a gap until that position can be filled. So this puts volunteers in a strange position as well, because there's no one to assign them, and then no one to support them. So if you have a good community, you could still have meetings and things, and they could still support each other and get through these times where they have less guidance.
Yeah. And I think it's also important to look at not just the past and the present of hospice volunteerism like we have so far, but also the future. So looking ahead as we're kind of wrapping up here, what do you think is that future generation of hospice volunteers looks like? Like, where are the places and untapped, you know, areas of opportunity that hospices can seek out these volunteers?
You know, obviously technology and the way people communicate is way different now, and so I think the sources where volunteers can be recruited, I think there's a bigger outreach. Facebook and all these other social media platforms are definitely different. But the other thing that's changing is too is that the volunteers have a better way to communicate with themselves, and they're, I think people these days that are more challenged with their personal schedules in this technology age and the things that they do. So yeah. I think again, having a good support network and good tools to support them in doing their work. So as far as the future goes, I think that another thing that we're seeing a major impact with is the use of AI. I think that this will help fill that gap. And so hospice training needs to, you know, inform volunteers about how they can, you know, support themselves. And some of the tools that we've created, we actually can tailor that AI interaction for the volunteers and the services we provide tailor it to the administrative policies of the organization in terms of, so they have this tool now that they can use during vigiling or 11th hour, you know, where they're supporting patient at the very last hours of their life. Mm-hmm. The tools that are available technology-wise, I think AI is going to be a pretty important one, and something that can be, you can limit you know, what it's telling the volunteer and the volunteer coordinator, for that matter. It's going to make that transition that I was talking about when a volunteer coordinator leaves. You can build a history in AI for your organization, and the volunteer coordinator can access, the new volunteer coordinator can access. So I would say AI is probably the biggest one. And there's a fear behind that. I'm an electrical engineer, and I have found that in my hospice work and in my technical work, that it's a phenomenal tool that will help people in every aspect of what they do.
Yeah. I mean, see what happened during the pandemic and how many virtual, different types of virtual or, you know, remote things that were offered through volunteers, and how they still wanted to help but were able to. There were so many different iterations of that. So it is going to be interesting to see how technology comes into play, to your point. So, all right. Well, that was really the last question that we had time for, Greg. Thank you so much for all of your insight. Any kind of final thoughts you wanted to leave us with?
I just think it's a wonderful place. And I would say we're actually at a place in hospice where I look back at the beginning of hospice, and there's something going on that we could talk about another time called compassionate communities. And there's specifically, again, this all came out of the UK, who started hospice. There's a Compassionate Neighbors program that they started in at St. Christopher's and St. Joseph's, affiliated with that, that's bringing in the community now as an extension of what volunteers do. And it's a great building. It's a network builder for hospices. So this is something that the Hospice Volunteer Association is working on, and I have another company called Compassion Gateways that is building these compassionate neighbor programs in the U.S. And so I think this is going to be another thing, along with AI, that is going to expand what we can do and have a closer relationship with the community, and having the community support families and people with challenging health conditions. So I think it's really an exciting time for me to be alive and to be participating in this. And it's going to have a very positive effects in, and this compassion community has been around for over 20 years. So it's not something new. It's just not very often talked about in the United States. So. Mm-hmm.
We'll see what happens next in the hospice volunteer world. Thank you, Greg, for walking us through this today.
My pleasure. Thanks, Holly.
Well, that wraps up this Elevate podcast. This is Holly Bossel, senior reporter for Hospice News, a WTWH media company. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for more episodes. Take care for now.